you soon. And when they do, you need to pay attention.
Jones nodded to Hargreaves and walked away. What did he mean about them coming for you? Hargreaves asked.
I don't know, but Gershwin Jones isn't into it. So if he has a feeling about this, I'm going to pay attention.
Chapter 69 Aggie Fire's Day, Sumer 7th.
Those police humans,
Josie said, as she and Aggie followed the footpath to the main house, leaving Eddie to watch the cabin.
Why do they keep chasing after us? We haven't found any scraps, and it's not like they want the food.
Aggie slipped an arm around Josie's waist.
The police are looking for clues.
They wouldn't find any. If the elders left any scraps for the Crow Guard, and other small forms of Terra Indigene, they wouldn't leave them on the shoreline within the jumble. But the police kept watching the crows, and every time a crow landed to inspect something near the water, one of the police ran over to see what the crow had found. Very annoying. How could anyone look for a snack when another predator was waiting to snatch it? Of course, she and Josie and Eddie hadn't gone hunting for snacks because the police were paying special attention to them, with different men coming over to the cabin to ask if they had seen anything when the Herschel human ended up in the water. Didn't humans talk to each other? Was that why they all asked the same questions? Or were they trying to confirm the information? Clearly, humans weren't as good as crows when it came to remembering things. And the police here worked so slowly compared to TV cops. But Miss Vicky had said stories on TV had to condense all the time it would take in the real world, glossing over the waiting and thinking time in order to keep the story interesting for the viewers. Having spent the day watching the police scour the beach for clues, Aggie approved of glossing over.
What's she still doing here?
The raised voice sounded rough. Must be the bruised throat female.
Things are bad enough now, but as long as she stays around, being here will only get worse. You have to do something. Force her out.
Aggie retreated, tugging Josie to come with her.
That's so sad, Josie said, as they walked back to the cabin. The Heidi human lost her mate, and now they want to force her to leave. Do you think the other females are afraid she'll try to steal one of their mates?
I don't think she wants one of the other males, Aggie said.
But the Heidi human wasn't being included in the Dane flock anymore, had stayed alone in her cabin yesterday, not even venturing out to find food. And none of the humans who were supposed to be her friends had brought any to her. As Josie said, it was sad that the human females were so determined to drive the Heidi human away, when they had been her friends the day before. But as the crows spent the rest of the day watching the humans wander around on the beach, Aggie had the uneasy feeling that she had missed an important clue. Chapter 70 Vicky Water's Day Sumer 8th
Are you having trouble figuring out where to shelve these?
Julian asked, eyeing the books on the top shelf of the cart.
No, no trouble.
Then...
He reached for one of the books.
If you didn't want me to look at the books, you shouldn't have asked me to dust the shelves.
Helping Julian in the store for the past couple of days showed me why I could never work in the bookstore on a regular basis. I'd buy all the stock.
That's the first pass. I'll shelve the ones I'm putting back.
He considered the books.
Do you have a prejudice against authors whose names begin with?
I raised my arm and stretched as far as I could without falling off the top step of the three-step stool, demonstrating that some books were not within the reach of a short person, which was why I hadn't selected titles written by authors whose names began with the first few letters of the alphabet.
Did Julian offer to find a taller stool or even a ladder?
No, he did not. He just grinned.
I'm going to the bank,
he said.
It's a little early for lunch, but I could pick up a pizza while I'm out and about. Does that have any appeal?
That sounds good, thanks. Oh, could you stop at the general store and pick up more carrots? I cut up the last ones for the Spreuinger's treat this morning.
I glanced at the books on the cart.
I'll put some of them back. Promise.
No need. If I paid you for helping me these past couple of days, I think we'd end up even.
I wasn't sure about being even, but I didn't argue because I really didn't want to put any of them back. They were an escape from a shaky future. Maybe I should throw away all caution and look into going out west, where you could apply to live in a town that was being repopulated. You had to be willing to work with the Terra Indigene, but I could do that. And leaving the Northeast should put enough distance between me and Yorick. Of course, I had no idea how a human applied to live in one of those towns, but Ilya Sanguinati might know. I'd slipped my medical information under his office door, including the name of the physician in Hubney. No reason I couldn't stuff the query about those towns under the door as well.
I'll be back as soon as I can.
Julian hesitated and rubbed the back of his neck.
Something doesn't feel right today.
In the village?
On Main Street. I'm not sensing anything stronger than that. Don't always sense more than that until the trouble is almost at the door, so to speak.
He looked at me, his gray eyes dark with worry.
I'll lock the back door when I leave. You have your mobile phone?
In my purse, which is in the break room.
Get it. Keep it closer.
Now I was worried. Should I warn Inike to stay away from the shops today? Another hesitation. Then he offered a grim smile.
Better safe than sorry, right?
Not really what I wanted to hear.
Right.
I followed Julian to the back of the store and listened as he locked the back door. Then I dashed into the break room, fetched my mobile phone, and called Inike. She couldn't insist that her guests stay away from the shops on Main Street, but she assured me that she and Paige and Dominique would stay at the boarding house. After promising to call with regular updates, we made a lame joke about calling it the Julian Report. I ended the call and immediately made another one. This time, I got an answering machine.
This is Silence Lodge. Please leave your name and...
yada yada yada. I left a message for Ilya, then went back to dusting the shelves, setting my mobile phone on the book cart so that it was an easy reach. I wasn't sure how long Julian had been gone. I'd gotten a bit distracted reading the cover copy of a few books, when I heard someone fumbling with the lock on the back door. Figuring he had his hands full, and that was the reason for the fumbling, I had just stepped off the stool, intending to help him, when I caught a movement out of the corner of my eye. That was fast. Except it wasn't Julian. Before I could grab the mobile phone and even try to call for help, Detective Swin shoved me against the bookcase, one forearm pinning me while his other hand rested on his service weapon.
You're coming with me. You're not going to make a fuss or call any attention to us. Say it. Say it.
I couldn't say anything at that moment.
If you don't say it, if you don't promise not to make a fuss, we'll wait right here, and when Julian Farrell returns, I will shoot him in the face. Not through the brain. I won't kill him. I'll shoot his face off. You got that, Fireplug? He'll spend the rest of his life with no eyes, no nose, no mouth. He'll be fed through a tube, and it will be your fault.
Swin would do it. He wanted to shoot Julian, whether I cooperated or not. The only way to keep Julian from getting hurt was to go with Swin and hope I would find a way to escape before he hurt me.
Coward.
I didn't even want to think the word kill. He wasn't taking me somewhere to hurt me, and we weren't going somewhere for a chat. Yorick and his pals had decided I was a problem that needed to go away, and Swin had been sent to fetch me. Shootout in Spreuing. It sounded like a frontier story, but I could picture the reality just fine. Shots fired on Main Street. Grimshaw running out of the police station, not seeing Swin, a fellow cop, as a threat until it was too late. Was Swin's arrival the wrongness Julian had sensed? Or was it something worse? Something more like what I was imagining? Except I could prevent what I was imagining.
"Say it," Swin growled.
"I won't make a fuss.
At least not while we were in the village." Swin grabbed my arm and pulled me out the back door and over to the cruiser parked behind the bookstore.
"You stole a Bristol police car?"
"Borrowed. Get in."
He aimed his service weapon at me and kept it trained on me while he circled to the driver's side and got in.
The windows were up. No one would hear if I tried to call for help.
But the handful of Sproingers who visited the bookstore were at the edge of the parking area.
Seeing me, they made the happy face. I made a sad face.
They hopped toward the cruiser. Swin drove off quickly enough to startle the Sproingers. Then, with more control as he turned onto Main Street and headed out of the village.
Chapter 71 Grimshaw. Water's Day, Sumer 8th.
"Wayne, something doesn't feel right."
Having cleaned his service weapon and backup, Grimshaw wondered if he should clean the shotgun next or walk down to Main Street to remind people of his presence. Hargreaves had called a few minutes ago to say that he and the CIU team were heading back to Bristol, along with the officers he'd called in for backup. The access road to the jumble was still blocked by the destroyed flatbed trucks and construction equipment, but all the bodies had been removed. Grimshaw pushed back from the desk and rolled his shoulders. He could use some fresh air. Besides, Osgood was already out patrolling and most likely had answered the beach question 100 times, so it was a good bet that no one would be asking him if the beach would reopen tomorrow. And Julian Farrow had called to leave a warning while he'd been on the phone with Hargreaves.
"Doesn't feel right,"
was a warning, but not a cause for alarm. Not yet. Hopefully, he could keep it that way. He reached the door when the phone on his desk rang.
"Sproing Police Station. Grimshaw speaking."
"Officer Grimshaw? This is Agent Greg O'Sullivan with the Investigative Task Force."
Grimshaw's heart bumped hard.
"You have something for me?"
"Probably not as much as you hoped for. I couldn't find anything of a criminal nature connected to the names on which you initially requested background information. That said, the men are known around the Hubney area as well-heeled entrepreneurs who have connections in a lot of businesses. Some of the deals they've put together look a little shady, but nothing crossed the line into illegal, at least on paper, if you follow me."
"I do."
Grimshaw swallowed his disappointment. He'd hoped the ITF agent would find some ammunition that proved Yorick Dane and his friends had used a forged document once before to take back property after enough money had been sunk into making capital improvements.
"Thanks for your help."
"I'm not done. Like I said, I didn't find anything criminal connected to the names you initially asked the ITF to check. But the last two? Mark Hammerson runs a security business and has skated charges a couple of times for protecting a client's assets with a little too much enthusiasm. And while no evidence was found, Tony Amarella's name has been linked with a couple of suspicious deaths."
"Gun? Knife?
Garrote?" Grimshaw shivered. He pictured the murder board as it had been the evening they'd spent at the jumble. Pictured Aggie setting a businessman on the square in front of Teeny Vicky, the square with a garrote beside it. Hearing an odd sound, he glanced toward the windows and froze. Sproingers scratching at the glass, tumbling off their companions and climbing up again in an effort to look in the windows. Scratch, scratch, scratch.
"Grimshaw?
I have to go."
He hung up on O'Sullivan and opened the station's door. A dozen of the critters crowded the doorway, with more Sporingers heading toward him. He scanned the street and spotted Osgood jogging toward him. He saw Julian walk out of the general store, stop at the sight of the Sporingers, and then look toward Lettuce Reed. Closed door. A woman inside. Alone. A predator with a garrote. Oh, gods. He ran across the street and down the narrow driveway that provided access to the parking area behind the store. Seeing the open back door, he drew his service weapon and approached cautiously.
Vicky? Vicky, are you there?
Julian rounded the corner, skidding to a stop when he saw Grimshaw.
I didn't leave that door unlocked. I didn't use the deadbolt, but I engaged the simple lock on the door. Could Vicky have let someone in? Who? Inike Xavier?
Julian hesitated, a silent acknowledgement of the possibility. He opened the screen door, allowing Grimshaw to slip in first.
Vicky?
Grimshaw called.
There's no one here,
Julian said, pushing past him and rushing into the break room.
But Vicky's purse is still here.
Grimshaw moved forward, bookshelves rising almost to the ceiling, hiding places everywhere.
Julian, look at this.
Books on the floor, as if someone had dropped them, or they had been pushed off the shelves. A mobile phone on the book cart.
She wouldn't leave without her purse,
Julian said.
And she wouldn't leave without telling me, not after I'd told her that something didn't feel right.
Hearing the screen door open, Grimshaw stepped into the aisle that ran from the back of the store to the front. But it wasn't Vicky Devine returning. It was Osgood.
The Sporingers are fair upset about something,
Osgood said.
They keep scratching at me.
Vicky Devine is missing,
Julian said.
Maybe there was an emergency? Did you ask Captain Hargreaves?
Grimshaw frowned.
Why would I?
Just before the Sporingers started to mob the station, I saw a Bristol police car leave this parking area and head west out of town.
A car going to Bristol from that direction would turn onto the road heading south, the same direction someone would take to go to the jumble.
Osgood, go back to the station. Call Captain Hargreaves and make sure he didn't send a car for Vicky. I'm heading to the jumble.
Osgood slipped out the door, tripping over Sporingers until he managed to get clear of them.
I'm going with you,
Julian said.
I'm not asking you.
I knew something didn't feel right, but I left her alone here, thinking it would be a safe place. I left her alone because I was going to be gone a short while. Window of opportunity. Someone saw it and took it. So I'm going with you.
Then let's go.
Chapter 72. Ilya. Waters Day. Sumer 8th.
Ilya, it's Vicky. Julian says something doesn't feel right on Main Street. I thought you should know.
He looked at the rest of the Sanguinati, who had come in to report a different kind of feeling. Something dangerous. Something lethal.
Problem? Natasha asked. Yes. Boris, please bring the car. We need to get to Spring.
Easier to travel in his smoke form, but the car would be necessary if he needed to quickly extract Victoria from the village. The phone rang before he took a step away from the desk.
Yes?
It's Julian Farrow. Someone driving a Bristol police car abducted Vicky. The car was last seen heading west, so it could be heading toward one of the four-lane roads that provide access to bigger cities.
But you think it's heading for the jumble?
Ilya wasn't asking a question.
Yeah, we're on our way there.
Ilya hung up and hurried out to the lodge's multi-level deck, going down to the lowest level.
Do you still need the car?
Boris asked. On the other side of the lake, he saw the crow guard flying up in alarm.
No, it's too late for that.
Where would they take Victoria? Farrow and Grimshaw,
because he understood that was what Pharaoh had meant by we would aim for the main house. But killing could be done anywhere. Just before he changed to smoke to race across the lake and help with the hunt, Natasha grabbed his arm and said,
"Look."
Shapes in the water.
"Stay where you are, Bloodhunter. We will tell you if you are needed."
He wanted to argue. After all, turning the jumble back into a viable Terra Indigene settlement was the Sanguinati's responsibility. His responsibility. And that included keeping watch over the vulnerable human who was caretaker and reader. But he knew better than to disobey a command when it came from one of them.
"Elia?"
Boris asked.
"We wait."
The words tasted bitter.
"But our enemies are over there," Natasha protested.
He nodded.
"So are the elders."
Chapter 73. Vicky. Water's Day, Sumer 8th.
I pictured opening the car door and flinging myself out of the vehicle while Detective Swin had to concentrate on something in the road. I pictured him punching me in the face if I reached for the door handle. I was in the front seat with him. Couldn't have me looking like a prisoner. But I didn't know if a passenger could unlock the door. So opening and flinging weren't good options. I pictured myself grabbing the wheel like a plucky young woman in a TV show and sending the car out of control and off the road, rolling a couple of times. Of course, the villain would be trapped, and Miss Plucky would crawl out of the wreck with a couple of dramatic cuts, but would still be able to show everyone why she had been a high school track star as she ran to warn the good guys that they were walking into a trap. Since I wasn't plucky, and, at 30, I wasn't considered young, and my experience with track and field events did not make me any kind of star, I was more likely to end up looking like bug goo on the windshield while Swin walked away from the wreck. Cross off grabbing the steering wheel from my save-the-day list. Then Swin turned onto the farm track that ran between the Milford's orchards and the jumble.
"Where are we going?"
I asked, feeling numb.
"Back to the beginning. You should have just rolled over like you were supposed to, Fireplug. All this trouble happened because of you."
"Actually, all of it happened because Yorick tried to renege on the divorce settlement. But I was pretty sure Swin didn't want to hear that."
"What the?"
Swin said. A chubby brown pony with a storm gray mane and tail stood in the middle of the farm track, blocking our way. When he stomped one foot, dirt swirled around his legs.
"Oh no," I breathed, recognizing Twister.
Instead of stopping because, hey, there was a pony in the way, Swin floored the gas pedal. Instead of running away from a speeding car, the pony charged and disappeared in the center of a mini tornado. Have you ever been on one of those stomach-churning spinny rides at a country fair? Well, spinning in a car is so much worse. I screamed. Swin screamed, and no matter what he might say later, it was not a manly yell. The car stopped spinning, and flames erupted from under the hood. "Aiden?" I clawed at the door and tumbled out of the car, feeling Swin's fingers slide over my butt as he tried to grab me. Since he had a gun and I didn't have so much as a nail file, I ran, figuring that having things like trees in the way would make it harder for him to shoot me.
"Come back here," Swin shouted,
like that was going to happen. Was this the trail I'd taken when I'd led Grimshaw to the first body? Didn't know and couldn't afford to care. I'd either end up at one set of cabins, or at the main house, or at the road. Hopefully, I wouldn't end up back on the farm track and run into Swin. I didn't run into Swin, but as I caught a glimpse through the trees of what I thought was the main house, I did run straight into a man wearing a business suit and thin black gloves. I'd come around a blind curve in the trail and bounced off him, stumbling back a couple of steps. I didn't recognize him, but I saw the tie clip. One of those weird moments when time slows down and you fixate on one detail. So even though I didn't know him, I knew he wasn't a friend. Not to me. I dodged him when he lunged at me. Don't ask me how. Adrenaline is an amazing thing. I was already puffing, so he wouldn't have to work hard to catch me, and I was sure that him catching me would be bad for my health. Not having any sensible ideas of how to evade the man, I waved a hand over my head as if I was holding a ticket and wheezed, "I have the Elder Helps You card!" Which shows you that, while adrenaline is an amazing thing, it can produce wonky thoughts in the brain, showing me a flashback of the murder game we had all played that one evening. Except, I saw nothing, but I swear I felt fur brush the bare skin on my arm as something big rushed past me. As it passed, it gave me a negligible swat, shove, toss, take your pick that had me airborne. Reminded me of when I used to do the running long jump when we had the track and field segment in gym class. Not that my long jump was long, but this, I was flying. I had plenty of time to remember there was a safe way to fall and roll when I landed. I didn't remember how, just that there was a safe way, and then there was the tumble the rest of us took. At the moment my feet touched the ground, I heard a hideous scream, a terrified, mind-breaking sound. With my concentration shattered, I landed in a heap. Couldn't think about what had just happened. Couldn't. As I pushed to my feet, I felt a sting in both knees, a sharp pain in my left wrist, and a queer feeling of sticky air along my right side. Couldn't think about that either. I needed to be out in the open. The main house was probably stuffed with York's friends, so I couldn't shelter there. But the beach? If I got to the beach and yelled for help, the Crow Guard would hear me. Maybe even Conan and Cougar if they were hunting nearby. Someone would see me, would know what happened to me. I ran and made rash promises to exercise more if I lived. Of course, if I died, exercising would be a moot point. As I ran past the main house, following the path to the lakeside cabins and the beach beyond them, several things happened. A voice that sounded like Julian's yelled, "Vicky!" Tittering female screams, not the "I'm being eaten" kind of screams, came from the screened porch. And Swin, waving a gun, fought his way between a couple of bushes and came at me. I was in sight of the lakeside cabins, sure that Swin was going to shoot me at any moment, when fog suddenly started playing hide-and-seek with the ground, with objects, with people.
Caw! 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 Caw!
Aggie and her friends? I hoped so. The fog thinned, revealing the sand.
Bitch!
Swin's voice, too close. Sand would slow me down. So would the water, unless I could get far enough out to be safe from bullets. I changed course and ran for the dock. Was that sensible? Who knows? It's what I did. Behind me, I heard Swin yell. I heard a big splash. A gun went off, and someone started screaming. I was almost at the dock when Yorick ran toward me, waving something shiny and yelling,
"Come back here, Vicky! It's all your fault! Come back here and fix this!"
I didn't know what he was holding. I just knew I couldn't let him get his hands on me. Men with guns and other weapons behind me. Ahead of me? Something else. The fog might have messed with my sense of distance, but it wasn't the reason I ran to the end of the dock and kept running until I hit the water. Chapter 74. Grimshaw. Waters Day. Sumer 8th. Spotting the smoke, Grimshaw slowed the cruiser.
"I need to call this in.
I'll call it in, Julian said, plucking Grimshaw's mobile phone out of the console. We need to reach the jumble.
He glanced at Julian's pale face and stepped on the gas. They weren't more than a couple of minutes away, but a couple of minutes could make a difference in saving a victim or standing over a corpse.
I don't know what's burning, but it's on the farm track between Milford's orchards and the jumble, Julian said to whomever was on the other end of the phone. If the wind picks up, the whole area could be in trouble.
He ended the call.
Volunteer fire department is on its way.
The mobile phone rang.
Julian answered. Officer Grimshaw's phone. Wait, I'll put you on speaker.
Sir?
Osgood. We've already called the fire department to handle whatever is burning on the farm track, in case that's what you wanted to tell me.
A beat of silence.
No, sir. I called to tell you Captain Hargreaves is boiling mad. Seems two of the officers who came with him as backup let a fellow officer borrow their patrol car. The captain was mad enough about that, since they didn't tell him about it. But when he threatened them with disciplinary action, they admitted they loaned the car to Detective Swin. That's when he really got mad. He's on his way back with, and I quote, reliable officers.
Tell Captain Hargreaves it's likely that those officers owe the Bristol station a car, Julian said.
Why?
Osgood asked. Grimshaw pulled to the shoulder near the game trail that they'd been using to reach the main house at the jumble.
Because that's probably what's burning on the farm track.
Do I have to tell him?
I'm heading up to the main house with Julian Farrow. You can tell him that.
Another beat of silence.
You should have backup. I'm on my way.
Grimshaw hesitated, then thought.
Either he has the stones for this work, or he doesn't. The trail to reach the main house has been marked. If you don't see us, get up to the main house and hold anyone who's inside. You got that?
Yes, sir.
Julian ended the call and handed the mobile phone to Grimshaw, who tucked it in its spot on his belt as soon as he got out of the car.
Damn, Julian said softly, as they started up the trail.
Fog swirled around them as they hurried toward the main house. Not a thick, enveloping fog, but almost flirtatious, veiling and revealing. Just enough that Grimshaw couldn't see the ground, couldn't see something that might trip him up enough that he'd sprain an ankle or wrench a knee. Injuries not normally life-threatening, but either would leave him useless and vulnerable. Once they reached the access road, they ran toward the main house, but stopped, frozen, when they heard a hideous scream. Grimshaw took a step toward the sound. Julian grabbed his arm.
No, Julian said. We can't go there.
The look in Julian's eyes. He'd seen it at the academy, and he'd seen it on the streets before they'd been assigned to different stations.
Are you seeing the real place? Or the jumble as it was represented in the murder game. They're the same now.
Julian shuddered, then headed for the main house.
They're the same.
Not good.
Vicky!
Julian shouted once they reached the main house. Female screams coming from the back of the house.
Wait!
Grimshaw said as he pulled out his phone and called Osgood's mobile phone.
Almost there, sir,
Osgood said loudly.
I can see your car.
Don't try to find me. Just get up to the main house and stay inside, Grimshaw said.
He ended the call and almost dropped the phone when Julian bolted, no longer able to wait.
Julian! Julian!
But Julian was running toward the far side of the house, following only Miko's knew what. So Grimshaw went around the other side. He wasn't sure Swin had brought Vicky Devine to the jumble. The man could have taken her farther down the farm track. Except the damn fog. It was here and nowhere else. He ran around the other side of the house. If Vicky was inside, he'd have to trust Osgood to deal with the situation as soon as the baby cop arrived. But he didn't need to be an intuit to have a bad feeling that Vicky Devine was out here. Somewhere. The fog around him cleared abruptly.
That was the only reason he didn't step on the body. Step in the body. Darren. Gutted. But not dead. Not yet. He hesitated. Nothing he could do for the man, but it felt wrong to leave him alone in the fog where the predators waited. Then he heard a gunshot and heard a man scream. That decided him. He ran to the back of the main house, heading for the dock. Splashing, thrashing, screaming, he had a glimpse of Julian pulling something out of the water. Then the fog became a wall, cutting him off from everything except Vicky Devine, running for the dock, and York Dane holding something in his right hand and yelling, "Come back here, Vicky! It's all your fault! Come back here and fix this!" York reached the land end of the dock, just as Vicky ran right off the other end and hit the water.
"Dane!" Grimshaw shouted. "Put the weapon down, now!"
Dane started to turn.
"Drop the weapon, or I'll shoot!"
Dane looked over his shoulder, his expression full of smirky disbelief.
"You going to shoot me in the back? Won't look good on your record, Chief. If I shoot you here, no one will ever find the body, so I can write up the report any way I please."
That wiped the smirk off Dane's face.
"It's not a weapon. It's just a wrench." "I don't give a damn what it is. Drop it and put your hands behind your head."
"Monkey man." Dane dropped the wrench and put his hands behind his head. Yeah, Grimshaw thought. Given the current choices, being arrested was Dane's only chance of getting out of there alive.
"Vicky!"
Julian calling.
"Vicky!"
Unfortunately, no one answered his call. Grimshaw handcuffed Dane, then leaned in to speak quietly in the man's ear.
"Just so you know, I don't care if you hire one of your tie-clip pals to get you out of whatever charges come from all of this. I don't care what anyone else says about your guilt or innocence. If Vicky Devine's body washes ashore, you and I are going to take a long ride deep into the wild country."
Chapter 75. Aggie. Waters Day, Sumer 8th. Air rode fog around the jumble, making it harder for the humans to find anything. That was good. The humans, well, she wasn't sure what the humans had been doing before air and fog galloped into the jumble, but it all felt sneaky.
"The elders are hunting," Eddie said.
Leaving the cabin's door open, Aggie went inside, removed her clothes, and shifted to her crow form. Looking human would not be a good thing today. Going back outside, she flew up to the porch roof, a good place to observe whatever she could see, but close enough to the cabin door if she needed a place to hide. Then Miss Vicky ran along the path, heading for the beach. Aggie shouted.
"Caw! Hide here! Hide here!"
But Miss Vicky kept running toward the beach, and moments later, that mean police human Swin appeared and ran after her.
"Gun!"
Aggie cawed.
"He's going to shoot Miss Vicky!"
Miss Vicky swerved at the edge of the sand and kept running toward the dock, disappearing into a wall of fog. Swin stopped at the edge of the sand, turned toward Miss Vicky, and raised the gun. Before Aggie could call another warning, a big wave suddenly rose and flooded the whole beach, creating new shallows at the same moment Cougar raced out of his hiding place and pounced on Swin. The gun went bang! Swin and Cougar landed in the water. Cougar leaped back to dry land, and Swin began screaming as the elders who lived in the lake, having ridden on the lady's wave to reach their prey, grabbed the human and began to tear and slash while they thrashed in the receding water, feeding until the lady made the next big wave to help them return to the lake. The next wave arrived at the same time that Julian Farrow reached the sand.
He ran into the water and grabbed Swin, playing tug with the elders, who continued to bite and feed as they retreated to the natural shallows. Then Julian let go of what remained of Swin and fell back, clear of the waterline. But he didn't leave, didn't move farther out of reach of the elders. Instead, he stared at something stuck in the wet sand. Had Julian found a shiny? She couldn't see what he had found, so she flew down to the beach. Coins sometimes fell out of torn pockets. Julian might share if there were several coins on the sand. But it wasn't coins that held the human's interest. It was the gun. Did he need the gun? Why? Another wave washed over the beach, higher than the usual waterline. Aggie saw the shape hidden in the water. Before Julian could lunge for the gun and get in teeth and claw kind of trouble, Aggie flutter-hopped to the gun and closed one foot over the trigger guard.
No!
Julian said, grabbing for the gun. Water washed around her and Julian like they were rocks, and the elder who had ridden in on that wave rose partway out of the water and took a swipe at Julian. He would have torn up Julian's arm, but Cougar smacked the human, knocking Julian out of the way.
He's Miss Vicky's friend,
Aggie said, trying to tug the gun out of the sand and away from the water. The elder stared at her with those strange eyes before thrashing his tail and returning to the lake with the receding wave. Cougar came up beside her and pawed at the gun.
Wait!
Julian's shaking hand closed over the gun. Aggie pecked him. He was too close to the water. It wasn't safe to be human until the elder stopped being angry.
Have to put the safety on,
Julian panted, his hand moving over the gun.
Can't have it go off by accident and hit someone.
Yes, that was smart. Since she didn't know how to do the safety thing, she stopped pecking him.
Okay, he panted. Okay.
He let go of the gun and crawled up the beach until he touched the grassy edge. Then he looked at the lake.
Vicky! Vicky!
No answer.
Miss Vicky is in the water,
Eddie reported. Nothing the crow guard could do for her there. Aggie shifted to human form, picked up the gun, and ran to where Julian lay on the wet sand. She set the gun beside him, remembering from stories to point it away from him, then shifted back to Crow and studied the human. Water leaked from his closed eyes. He was not paying attention. That wasn't smart, with so many of the Terra Indigene feeling angry toward humans. Did she care? Did it matter? He was Miss Vicky's friend, and so was she. Perched on Julian Farrow's raised knee, Aggie cleaned her feathers while she kept watch. Chapter 76. Vicky. Water's Day, Sumer 8th. It didn't matter if I wanted to go back to the Jumbles Beach or go on to Silence Lodge. I had reached the point of no return. I was done, exhausted and hurt. My side felt strange, but I was too scared to touch it and find out why. A wave caught me in the face, and I thought my side would rip as I coughed up the water I'd swallowed. Then I saw the shapes coming toward me, saw a delicate dorsal fin, the flick of a tail. They surfaced all around me. If I hadn't been so brutally tired, I would have been terrified. Imagine a creature whose ancestors had been a giant piranha that had mated with a lake-dwelling species of human. They had a human-like torso that ended in that kind of tail shown in sketches of mermaids. The backs of their bodies were a blue-black that changed to a silvery-gray front. Big fish eyes. And triangular, interlocking teeth that could tear flesh from bone, easily stripping a carcass in minutes. Elders. The long-standing or long-swimming residents of Lake Silence. They raised their heads above the water, bobbing to keep the gills in their necks wet.
I can't swim anymore,
I said. I didn't know if I was asking for help
or telling them that this prey didn't have the strength to fight them. Two of them bobbed under the water on either side of me. When they surfaced, my arms were around their narrow shoulders, holding me up. I wasn't much help, but they maneuvered until we faced the shoreline near Silence Lodge. An undulation of water lifted all of us, as if we were all riding on the back of something that had risen from deep in the lake to become a long, gentle swell. An arched back that rose and went back down. But the motion had brought all of us noticeably closer to the shore. The third time that undulation occurred, I imagined I saw a giant head and shoulders right in front of me. A body that was never separate from the lake, but still distinct. We were inside of the shore faster than I would have thought possible. Silence Lodge didn't have my nice beach. Dark pebbles. Maybe shale. Shale had sharp edges. Landing on it would hurt. Not that I had a choice. I wasn't sure my companions understood human speech, and they weren't likely to spend their time pondering the preferences of shoreline material. My vision blurred. The elders who had been holding me up dropped away. And I rode that last undulation to the shore alone. Chapter 77 Ilya Water's Day, Sumer 8th.
Come to the shore, Bloodhunter. We are bringing the reader to you. She is wounded.
To the shore, Ilya told the rest of the Sanguinati. Hurry!
He shifted to smoke and rushed to the shore, followed by Natasha and Boris. The other Sanguinati spread out to cover the rest of the shore in front of the lodge. As soon as he reached the water's edge, Ilya shifted back to human form and saw the swell and the beings riding it. Twice more a swell formed under the beings, carrying them closer to shore. Then the elders swam away, leaving Victoria to ride the final swell alone. As the Lady of the Lake lifted Victoria Divine above the stony shore, Ilya raised his arms to catch the Jumble's caretaker.
Chapter 78 Grimshaw Water's Day, Sumer 8th.
As Grimshaw marched York Dane to the big screened porch at the back of the main house, he looked for Julian. Instead of spotting his friend, he saw crows gathering near something on the beach. The land sloped, denying him a visual of the beach itself, but he could guess what would attract so many of the crow guard. Gods above and below. Cougar appeared over the rise, moving away from the beach. The panther saw him and stopped. As Grimshaw watched, Cougar looked back toward the beach. Then a front paw changed into a furry human hand that gave him a thumbs up before the hand became a paw again, and Cougar continued moving toward the cabins. Somehow, that human gesture to indicate something, or someone, was all right, disturbed him more than the bodies he'd glimpsed in the past few minutes. But if he understood the message, Julian had survived.
Osgood,
Grimshaw called, as he and Dane approached the porch.
Sir!
Osgood scanned the area, then unlocked the screen door and held it open while Grimshaw muscled Dane inside.
According to Mrs. Dane, one of the women should be at the lakeside cabins.
I'll check it out.
He pushed Dane into one of the chairs.
Stay there.
Where's Darren?
Where is Vaughn?
Grimshaw eyed the women. There was fear under the bitchy attitude.
Darren is dead. I think Swin is dead. I didn't see Vaughn.
He hadn't gone looking.
Why is York in handcuffs?
Constance Dane said.
You can't arrest him.
Yes, I can.
He used the tone of voice that was so polite, so professional, no one had ever mistaken it for anything but a threat.
Police!
Hargreaves, from the front of the house. Backup had arrived.
Back here,
Grimshaw bellowed. Hargreaves appeared in the kitchen doorway. He looked at the women, then at York Dane.
Who was under arrest?
All of them, Grimshaw replied.
What's the charge?
Constance Dane demanded, jumping to her feet.
Fine.
Grimshaw uncuffed Yorick Dane.
Either you're all under arrest, or I chuck you all out the door, and you can take your chances.
Something near the porch laughed, a sound so full of terrible glee that it made Grimshaw's body clench, made Hargreaves' face tighten, made beads of sweat pop up on the foreheads of the officers standing behind the captain.
We'll take them to the police station in Sproing and sort out the charges there, Hargreaves said. What are we starting with? Abduction, Grimshaw replied, as his mobile phone rang. Possibly murder.
He turned away from the people on the porch and covered one ear with a hand in order to hear the person on the phone.
Grimshaw.
Bring a doctor and medical equipment to Silence Lodge, Ilya Sanguinati said.
Leaving the porch, he took several steps away from the house, ignoring Hargreaves's low protest.
You found Vicky? Do we need to take her to the hospital in Bristol?
A slight hesitation.
I don't think she has time to reach Bristol.
Oh, gods.
We'll be there.
Grimshaw ended the call and shouted,
Julian! Julian! We need to get to Silence Lodge.
He held his breath and almost gave up, almost turned back to the porch to tell Hargreaves where he was going. Then he saw Julian running up from the direction of the beach, Krogard flying all around him.
Grimshaw?
Hargreaves said as he left the porch's illusion of safety and joined him on the lawn. He placed the call to the medical office while he waited for Julian to join them. Seeing the crows land all around them, he resigned himself to a less-than-private report.
Medical office,
a female voice said.
This is Officer Grimshaw. Tell Dr. Wallace that the Sanguinati found Vicky Devine. It sounds like she's in bad shape, but she's still alive.
I'll contact the EMTs. Their vehicle is equipped for emergencies.
Do that.
He ended the call.
Hospital?
Julian asked. Grimshaw shook his head.
Ilya says there isn't time.
He looked at Hargreaves.
Can you take the lead on processing the scenes and handling the arrests?
Hargreaves gave him an odd look, which didn't surprise him. The captain was still his boss, was still the one in charge, and yet he was treating the man like they were of equal rank.
I can do that for you, Hargreaves said. Would appreciate a call when you know Miss Devine's status.
Grimshaw nodded. Then he looked at the crows.
Captain Hargreaves and his men have to collect the bodies and process the scenes, like the cops do in the TV shows. They're going to be walking around the jumble, collecting evidence. Can you let everyone else know that it's all right for them to be here?
The crows looked at each other. Then one looked up at him and said,
Caw!
Taking that as agreement, he and Julian ran down the trails to reach the cruiser and head for the lodge on the other side of the lake. Chapter 79 Aggie Waters Day, Sumer 8th. Being considered part of the team made watching all the poking and pecking done by the human police more interesting, but it was still frustrating.
But why do they need all the shinies?
Josie asked for the fifth time.
The bad humans hurt Miss Vicky, so everything they had is evidence,
Aggie replied.
But they're dead. Human police can't arrest them if they're dead, can they?
Aggie had never seen a TV cop arrest a dead man, or parts of a dead man. Maybe Julian Farrow would know?
They're going to let the eyeballs go to waste,
Eddie complained. That was true, and it was sad. But the cops were just human and would never appreciate the edible qualities of fresh eyeballs, so there wasn't much the Crow Guard could do. The Crow Guard living in the jumble had gathered and then divided, several of them taking watch over each group of humans who were gathering evidence. Most of the crows hadn't seen any of the cop and crime shows, hadn't talked about the stories with Miss Vicky,
so they had many questions about what the human police were doing. Was it usual for them to regurgitate food when they were collecting meat? Aggie was pretty sure experienced cops didn't do that. Not often, anyway. She was also pretty sure most of the experienced cops who had come to help Officer Grimshaw had never seen what an angry elder could do to a human body. But these cops seemed smart, even if they were human. The one she was watching collect evidence held up a long piece of shiny string and said, "It's a garrote." Garrote. She knew that word from the murder game. Humans used it for killing other humans, and maybe smaller Terra Indigene. Her cop looked up at the branch where she had perched to watch him.
"Is this the reason he died like this? He was attacking the woman who was your friend?"
"Was." That word made her sad, but she answered him anyway.
"Caw."
A glint of something caught her eye, but the cop was moving away. Aggie flew from the branch to the ground. Bit of black cloth, small finger, and a gold ring clinging to the skin. She looked at the cop still searching for evidence but moving away. She could pull off the ring, hide it under some leaves. She could... Part of the team. You didn't hide things from the team.
"Caw."
When he didn't answer, she tried again.
"Caw."
"Did you find something?"
He returned and crouched near where she stood guard over the finger.
"I guess you did."
When he reached for the finger, she pecked him. Couldn't help it. It was her shiny.
"Hey!"
Sorry. She moved out of pecking range to avoid pecking him again. After all, she was the one who had called him over to take the meat and treasure. Once he collected the evidence, she flew back up to the branch in the nearest tree to have a better view of what the humans were doing. That's why she spotted the man walking toward them. A man with red hair, tipped with blue and yellow.
"Sir," her cop said, "you can't be here. This is a crime scene."
"Don't make him angry,"
Aggie thought.
"Not him, not in the woods."
Recognizing that what approached him wasn't human, the cop took a step back. Fire looked up.
"I came to tell Aggie that the human doctor fixed Miss Vicky. She needs to be given medicine at specific times and needs to be watched for a day or two, so the Sanguinati are keeping her at Silence Lodge for the rest of today and tomorrow. They will tell you when you can visit."
"Caw!"
Miss Vicky was alive. Fire gave her cop a long look, as if memorizing his face. Then he walked away and disappeared. Miss Vicky was alive. That news was even better than finding a shiny. Chapter 80. Vicky. Waters Day, Sumer 8th. I woke from a dream where I was at the jumble, serving raw fish sandwiches to my toothy guests and trying to explain the appeal of pickled herring.
"Easy," Ilya said. "Don't struggle."
He restrained me with one hand while opening the blanket wrapped around me with the other.
"We thought some fresh air would do you good, but didn't want you to catch a chill. Not in your condition."
I had a condition? That didn't sound good.
"Do you want some water? Some juice? There is also chicken soup. I was told it is a good food for humans to eat when they have been ill."
"I've been ill?" I sounded like a frog, so that was possible.
"You were injured."
Ilya took a seat near the lounge chair positioned in a shady spot on the lodge's top deck. When he just sat there, looking like he did not want to be the bearer of bad news, I pushed the blanket open a little more in order to take stock. I was wearing a loose tank top and shorts. No bra. Or the bra had somehow missed my breasts and was hugging my ribs. A cast covered my left arm from knuckles to mid-forearm.
"You broke your wrist," Ilya said.
"Right." I hadn't landed properly after the flying long jump.
"He didn't mean to hurt you."
Ilya said.
He certainly did.
Ilya looked pained.
The man in the business suit. I ran into him when I was running away from Swin. He meant to hurt me.
Not him. The elder.
Oh. I remember.